Hey, Scott.
What's up, man? How are you?
I am pretty good right now.
Back for another episode. Let me ask you something. What do you think about our name, Turtlesmith? You like it?
Well, I do like it. After a lot of thought that you put into it, I think it's one of those things where it makes people think about it. Like, what does it mean?
Yeah, well, you know, a turtle blacksmith, I felt like the turtle kind of went along with our get rich slow motto, and then, you know, smith of making something. But to be honest with you, I had about 36 good names, and we couldn't find a dang domain name that we could also get. Everything was way too expensive. It was ludicrous.
Well, that's a problem these days, you know, getting so-called top-level domains, you know, the .com and so on. That's hard to find these days with a lot of the names that are out there, and then a lot of the registrars, they will basically take names. So even sometimes when you're searching for names, you'll go back the next day and find out that those names were now taken.
Right, yeah. What kind of a scummy business, but I guess they make a lot of money, so who knows. But yeah. I kind of like it. I think it's a fun one. This is our podcast logo only that we have here, and then we've got a more professional one that Calvin puts on there. But I think it's a fun name, so hopefully it'll become a household name in the future.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing it on big, tall buildings.
Yeah, hopefully with Terry the Turtle, our mascot here, just riding.
Is that his name now,
Terry? I don't know. I just made that up on the spot.
I think we call him a different name every week.
Yeah.
I going to have an identity crisis.
Yeah, that's the gimmick maybe. So, this week's segment is actually a reshoot, just to be kind of completely transparent. We shot this before, but the cameras were a little blurry when they were pointing at me, so we've kind of redone our processes to tighten that up, and we're going to reshoot it. So hopefully it's just as good as the last one we did. But become an expert is the second step of phase one of the planning phase, and this is where you really need to become an expert in your industry as a whole, not just the trade or craft or specific thing that you're doing. Because if you're starting a business with something, you should already be an expert. If you're starting a plumbing business, you should already be a master plumber. If you're starting a clothing brand, you should already be in the fashion industry at some point, you know, hopefully. But this is really about becoming an expert in the industry as a whole. And a lot of people think that they may be able to skip this step, but I really encourage you to take some time and think about it. Here's where we want to be studying, you know, new tech. Oh, I got my phone ringing. Here's where we want to be learning about new technologies in the industry, economic changes, regulatory concerns, market growth or decline, and just kind of becoming an expert in your industry. And the end goal of this step is to be able to teach a class. And so if you can get up in front of a classroom and talk for an hour about your industry as a whole and the things that are happening within the industry and changes that may be occurring, then you've completed this step. So the first kind of thing you should do is figure out what industry you're in. And so there's a thing called the North American Industry Classification System, NAICS codes, and that's a pretty good indication of what industry category you fall in. So JB Cases is 423910, which is sporting and recreational goods and supplies. S&H Business Services falls under kind of this broad category of 541200, which is accounting, tax prep, bookkeeping, and payroll services. And then you have kind of narrower focuses sometimes, like for me, tax prep services is 541213. Payroll services, 541214. And this is not terribly important to know, but it's a really great starting point to determine your industry. Have you ever heard your NAICS code before? Or?
Only in regards to customs declarations, I think.
Yeah.
When you're bringing in goods and stuff like that. And I don't know if that actually is quite the same, though, because these are the industry classification systems, and I don't know if there's a separate one for the products. For individual products.
I believe there is. Yeah. This is specifically, I use it for taxes. So on every tax form, I have to indicate what business category that companies fall under using this NAICS code system.
Yeah. So I would say that's probably different then. It's if I remember right, the customs one is a harmonized tariff code is what they call it.
Right. Right. And there's a couple other industry classification codes out there. This is just the one that's most commonly used for tax returns and stuff. But the reason to kind of figure out what industry code you're in is because it should help inform some of the other research you're going to do. Particularly, you can look at websites like the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the economic reports, market reports, and you can kind of narrow down which ones you need to look at by using this classification system.
So basically what we're talking about here is what we're mostly talking about is people want to start a small business.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of small business owners like myself, they just sort of jump in. Now, there's a lot of things that a lot of money I could have saved and a lot of time I could have saved by studying my industry. So back when I got started, though, back in 1992, there was no internet. Now, at least there was no usable internet for most of us.
Right.
And
I don't think I had usable internet till I was like 17 or 18 almost. So missed that whole generation.
I want to say that for me, it was around 97 or so that I started to get online.
Yeah. I think 2002 is when we got cable internet at the house.
Right.
That was the first time I had it at home.
So with the advent of the internet, though, now there are groups out there. There are informal groups of tradespeople mm-hmm. that get together, or people in the business, not necessarily a trade, but you know, whatever it is, if it's leather working, if it's skateboarding, whatever it is, there's a group of people out there somewhere, or multiple groups of people who are in that business who are willing to share their own journeys and what, you know, what the tips and tricks that they find, the regulations, the, you know, whatever it is that they have to deal with, they're willing to share that.
And I feel like we've talked about that a couple times, where just don't be afraid to reach out, because people really do want to help and they're really excited to talk about their industry most of the time.
Absolutely. And these are the experts, you know, and if you hang around these groups enough, you'll learn. You'll see the people who are newbies like yourself, and you'll see the experienced people. And if anyone gets on there and puts on a bunch of bullshit, then, you know, the other people will jump on them and it'll be a self-correcting thing. But yeah, that's super important. And also, there's trade industry groups that you can get into. These are real groups that their only job is to keep on top of what's going on in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they're also lobbyists, you know, so they'll lobby for the industry as well. But they put out a lot of position papers. They put out a lot of information, you know, economic information. Sometimes they'll have databases and things like that, so you can look up things by, for example, how many households are there in a city or something, you know? They'll have like a link to that resource. If you're a plumber, for example, you might want to know that.
Yep. Yeah, this is where you can kind of figure out where all those things are and get all those reports kind of in place for yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, from my side of it, I would have saved $5,000 if I knew anything about leather before I jumped into making leather pool cue cases.
Yeah.
Because I paid $5,000 for the wrong kind of leather.
What did you ever end up doing with that? I think you've told that story before where you bought too much. So the wrong kind of leather, it was just unusable for your purposes. Did you ever find a way to repurpose it, or was it just a loss completely?
I cannot really remember, but I think that we may have sold some of it.
Yeah.
Or I may have been able to trade some of it with another leather broker.
Yeah,
but it's so long ago, but mostly I took a loss.
Yeah,
I mean, I'd say that if I got $1,000 out of that at the end of the day, then that would have been a win.
Well, and you mentioned that you sort of jumped into your business without doing too much planning, and I think a lot of people end up doing that. I, to some extent, even myself, I sort of jumped into it without planning everything that I really needed to. And you can absolutely be successful by just jumping into stuff, but I almost guarantee you that it's going to cost you in the long run by not taking the steps at the beginning. And that's really, I think, what we're trying to preach here, is that if you just take these steps, it'll save you money and save you time and headache, and you'll be able to skip a lot of the mistakes that people make.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And the thing is that the mistakes that people make are not generally mistakes they're not generally mistakes of negligence so much as they are of inexperience.
Yeah. Well, and just ignorance, but a little bit, because right, there's so
ignorant.
Much to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that the people that you deal with now in my business, you know, back then we were trying to sell wholesale. We were looking for those big accounts. Those guys will run over you. You know, if you don't know what you're, if you don't walk in there already as an expert, they'll just walk right over you. You know, if you don't know what terms are, if you don't, and these are just general business principles, but they also, you have to know how they apply to your industry as well.
100%.
You don't know what net 30 means.
Yeah, we go into a lot of that specific business related lingo and terms later in the steps. But here, when you become an expert, you will then know how to apply those terms to your industry later on. So I mentioned in here that when you're doing your research, Google's kind of your best friend. You want to just Google, search for everything, try to find forums like you talked about, networking groups, industry articles, anything you can find. I don't suggest that you spend too much money on paywalls or market reports. Some of those market reports can be several thousand dollars, and there's no real need for them at this step. It's more just trying to put as much free resources together as you can and trying to sift through some of that misinformation that usually occurs when you're looking, trying to find anything.
Yeah, absolutely. I would also say, you know, that anything that you find, you can run it by the groups as well. So if you're part of all these groups, then you find information, you can say, hey, I'm new to this. I found this report, you know, that you didn't have to pay for. Okay. Because we don't want to, you know, we don't want you going thousands of dollars in the hole to get reports that you don't know the real value of.
Right.
But any information that you do get, you can run it by these groups and stuff and see what the elders in the business have to say, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. So in this sort of step two, we want to focus not only on the market and the industry, but one of the biggest killers of industries and jobs is technology and advancements. So you really want to spend a little bit of time seeing what's coming down the pipeline for your specific industry, new technology, new equipment that can be used. You were just showing me a picture right before we started this of a UV printer thing that was just going to change a lot of stuff. You don't have to realign everything. What was it exactly that it was doing?
So basically, this is a printer where allegedly you can just like throw out a bunch of pieces on the table here. And then as the printer head passes over, it locates the thing, it knows the orientation, and it automatically prints on that thing the correct graphic or whatever's supposed to be printed on there in the right orientation, in the right spacing and everything. Whereas before, you would have to spend a lot of time getting everything lined up exactly perfectly. And if you were even, you know, a fraction of a millimeter off, then you're going to ruin a lot of parts because from the left side to the right side, you know, you're going to end up off on the right side and you're going to have parts that are half printed, for example.
If it's not aligned perfectly.
Yeah, if you haven't got it dead calibrated perfectly. And so a lot of time would be spent doing jigs. Well, if this printer does exactly what it's advertised to do, then that literally means that I can throw a piece of paper like that or like whatever orientation I want, and that piece of paper would get printed exactly as it's supposed to be.
And that's one of the kind of things that'll revolutionize a couple different industries if it comes to full fruition and really works, and anybody who's not using that is going to be behind the eight ball.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the amount of time for a print shop that would save is enormous. Because a lot of, you know, and that's what a lot of print, that's what a lot of businesses, and this is another thing when it's, you know, we talked about this before about, you know, pricing, you know, and knowing your cost. Mm-hmm. But this is also where it comes in as part of knowing your industry.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know the machines, now it's really sexy to go out there and start looking at machines and shopping, right? Because everybody's got these dreams in their head about how many they're going to produce and, you know, but not only do you have to know the pricing in your industry, you have to know what people are selling similar items for and so on, but you also have to know how long it takes you to make that. So for example, you're out there looking at machines, but you don't at that moment really know how long it's going to take you to do setups. Right. So a lot of shops will charge for the setup because of the tool change.
Yep.
Because they have to do the jigs, they have to recalibrate the machine, they have to do all this, and this can take hours in some places.
That's why you find so often that when you order in bulk, it's so much cheaper just because there's a fixed fee for them to do anything. So if they print 100, that fixed fee is still the cost if they print 10,000.
That's exactly right. You know, you could say like a tool change cost, you know, for some of these places might be, let's just say $500, right? Well, they'll take your order for 100 pieces, you know, but they'll charge you $100 a piece for those pieces.
Right.
Plus the 500, right? But what they really want to do is they want to take that same $500 setup and they want to sell you 10,000 pieces, you know, at $20 a piece.
Right. So technology and advancements, really important to look at. The other one is just sort of the general overall economics of your industry. Economics is so vast. Nobody's going to become an expert in this overnight. You know, it's a whole PhD degree path to become, you know, skilled in talking about economics. But you should look at your specific industry. And there's a lot of reports, you know, find out if your company's or your industry is trending upward or if it's maybe on the downslope, depending on what kind of business it is. But looking into just the general economics of your industry is very important. And then the next thing you want to think about too is just what are the other parts of your industry? You know, we talked about, we've used the example of a plumber, I think a few times in different podcasts, but just because you're an expert on plumbing, you know, all the other parts that go to get a plumber to a job site to do the work, what are all those other parts of the industry that exist? You know, the administrative, the marketing, the IT, scheduling, bookkeeping for paying bills and all that stuff. So you don't necessarily have to be a master at bookkeeping and admin to be a good plumber or have a good plumbing business, but you should at least know what the hell's going on within your industry. So that's really important. So like we said, the end goal of this is sort of to just look at all of these, you know, economics, the technology, and just everything that kind of goes into your industry, the market reports and all that, and just become an expert in your specific industry with the end goal of being able to teach a class. And that's kind of all. We'll have a lot of resources on this topic, a lot of different places you can go to find reports that we recommend, different news outlets and authorities within the industry reporting world that we like to use for our purposes. So any other thoughts on becoming an expert?
Well, you know, I do have one quibble about the, you know, be able to teach a class.
Okay.
I think that there's, you know, there are some industries, you know, where you're not going to be able to get up there and teach a class to actual people who are in the industry if, mm-hmm. with, you know, if you don't know much yourself when you're starting out on this right. journey. But I don't want that. I just want to mention that I don't want to let that discourage people, you know, because sometimes it's kind of nebulous, you know, when you say like teach a class, and I'm just going to relate this to stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of people watch comics and they think, oh, that guy's pretty good, you know?
Right.
And they don't realize how much actual work it took to get to that point.
Yeah.
And in comedy, they will often say your first 15 minutes is your hardest, where you've got a really super solid 15-minute set.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many of you out there who have gotten up and tried to do like open mic at comedy.
I would not brave enough for me to do it.
Let me put it this way. 60 seconds has never felt so long.
Have you done it? You did it somewhere?
Yeah, I've tried a couple times, yeah. You know, and you know, a couple times I had a couple good jokes and then I'd bomb, you know, because you don't realize how much work it takes to actually get the timing down to get a good solid flow. And comedians are always working on their jokes, for example, and always trying to tighten it up. Mm-hmm. So just remember that you can learn enough about an industry to give you a good idea of whether you want to be in it or not. Mm-hmm. And depending on how much time you put into it, in this becoming an expert part, you could learn enough to teach a class. But I don't want people to get the idea that if they're not able to teach, if they don't feel confident enough to get up in front of industry people and talk about this industry, that they're not expert enough to continue on the journey of this business.
You know, that's an interesting point. I used the teach a class as sort of just a metaphor of being able to stand up and talk about it for an hour just to a layman and kind of explain the different industry. But you also raise a good point. Maybe it's a better end goal to just decide, is this an industry that you want to be a part of? Do you feel like this is a growth industry or a good industry for you to put your time and energy into? So maybe that's like a secondary goal that we can throw in.
Yeah,
there as
well. I mean, and I would say that if you're studying, and the overall point here is, for me, is take the time to learn about what it is you want to get into before you just jump into it.
Right.
No matter how good you think you are, like Like, for example, we know people that are good with their hands that can do, you know, they can do construction, mm-hmm. but they don't know the construction business, for example. They don't know the difference between, you know, having to go to Home Depot 10 times a day for a job, and going to a particular building supply place, you know, that that has everything they need, where they can just, if they sit down and they think about the job and they really plan it out, then they spend an hour planning out what tools they need and what supplies they need, and they, you know, send it over to the building supply place and everything's ready for them.
Yep.
Those guys, you know, they get over there with their truck, they get loaded up, they're done, they're out on the job site. They very rarely have to go somewhere else to get something else. And then we all know the handyman who, like, I had one guy that worked for me, you know, he passed away last year, unfortunately, mm-hmm. The guy that, you know, did a lot of the renovation in here. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know, you know, that it was, the end result was good, but, you know, it took a lot longer than it needed to because he was always running here and there. And
yeah, I'm trying to think about every DIY project I've done at home, how much time has been wasted going back to Home Depot for that one part I forgot, and then realizing I need another part,
that's because we don't know these things, right? So there's you don't know what you don't know, but then when you start trying to do something, then you and especially when it's costing you money, now you're coming up against something, and this will happen to me a lot too. I'll start a project with every intention of finishing it. Then after the third trip to the store, I'm like, forget it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And but it's worse when you're trying to start a business. And that's really what we're trying to say to you here is you got to put in the time, you know, to learn this. Because you think about it like this. If you put in the time, and we haven't put a time horizon on any of this, right? But just for the sake of argument, let's say that you put in a solid 2 months of going on forums, studying, really reading over the data sheets on the materials, you know, really identifying who, I mean, you got to treat this like you're a spy agency or something. You're gathering a portfolio, you're gathering intel so that when you're ready to hit the ground, you know what you're doing.
Right.
Because otherwise, doing that is going to save you years of heartache, years of pain. There's going to be times when you're going to be so excited to buy a machine, but you don't really know much about these machines, and you're going to jump right in and you're going to spend a lot of your net worth, you know, a lot of your available cash on this machine that you think is going to be great, only to find out it's really not good for your particular need.
Yeah.
You know, like it'll work, but it's going to cost you a lot more work to make a profit out of it. Whereas if you went with a different machine, you know, to kind of go with what we were talking about before, you might have to pay, say, $5,000 more for that machine, but you end up saving $50,000 every year in labor.
Yeah, in the long run, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of times you just want to, you get excited when you see something and it looks like it's a good deal, and that's where the knowledge comes in. And you can get this knowledge, and you can get the advice from people who've already been there, and you just have to avail yourself of it. So that's what I see as becoming an expert is all about.
That's fair enough. And I think that's spot on for what we're trying to do here. So, well, I think that's it for becoming an expert. Check out all the information on turtlesmith.com. There's be a lot more resources and information there.
Yeah. So we're not throwing you in the pool and saying swim. So turtlesmith.com, go check it out. Go to this step and you will find that we have every little bit of advice that we can give you. We're going to give you. You'll know that everything's factual. We verified it. We double-checked it. But if we happen to miss something, let us know and we'll fix it. But the main point is that we are in the business of helping you to be prepared to do your business and build a sustainable business that you can have a good, solid income off of. So, and that's what this is all about.
It's great points. Great points. This podcast is brought to you by S&H Business Services. We are serving the OKC and greater Oklahoma area. We offer tax preparation, accounting, bookkeeping, and payroll services for small businesses and individuals. You can find us at shbusinessservices.com. Again, that's S&H Business Services, found at shbusinessservices.com.
All right. So, Scott, I have something that I want to talk about that is really pissing me off.
Okay.
Scammers.
It's a nightmare, isn't it?
They are a plague on fucking humanity.
Yeah.
Or you know what? That's not even the right way to say it. They are a fucking plague on humanity.
Yeah.
Okay? So I think we should go back to the days where we boil people in oil whenever we catch one of these assholes.
Yeah, I love the YouTube videos where the guys are shutting down the scam call centers and wasting their time. It cracks me up.
Yeah, those are heroes, in my opinion. And they've even taken it to the point where they've actually gone to India. They've taken it to the point where they've gone to India sometimes physically to confront these guys sometimes, and that can be pretty dangerous.
Oh, no.
But so I want to talk about some types of scams that plague consumers and business owners that people have to beware of. So the thing that I'm currently dealing with is clone scams on Facebook. So we've built up our business where we have a pretty good following on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past couple of years, what has happened is there is a lot of scammers out there that what they will do is they will create a fake page. They will go into buy and sell groups. They will find the popular products and they will identify the trusted sellers,
yeah,
the active sellers. And so what they'll do is they'll make fake profile pages, personal pages, and then they'll make fake business pages. And they will either impersonate a business or they will impersonate a person's name. And they will infiltrate these groups. And then a lot of the admins aren't paying attention. The admins themselves don't know how to spot who
spot
the scammers
the
are.
Yeah.
And then these guys will put up stuff for sale that they don't have. And they will transact in PM. So they will only say in private messages, when somebody asks a question, they will say, PM me, private message me. And then they will start, you know, telling the person the price and send the money. And then they will always ask for the money in a way that is non-reversible. So, which I also think is a problem. You know, I think that that these payment companies, you know, need to be on top of this as well. Because they make it possible to have these non-reversible payments to these scammers. And I think that they should be able to identify the types of transactions that are most likely to be a scam, and they should hold it in kind of a holding pattern or an escrow for, you know, a period of time so the customer has time to figure out whether he got scammed or not.
It's a clever idea. Banks have that problem too, though. My business accounts, I only have like 1 day to identify a fraudulent transaction. And then if it processes, I'm screwed. So if I don't look at my bank accounts every day or 2 days, which we do for our big clients too, and we don't find a scam quickly, you're out of luck.
Oh, it's horrible. You know, and Facebook, for example, is absolutely terrible about this. The clone scammers have figured out how to evade their algorithm. And any human can look at these guys and see that they're a scammer, you know, like 99.9% chance that they're going to be a scammer. But the way Facebook treats it, you know, if they're not overtly breaking a rule, in other words, there can be 10,000 John Bartons on there selling pool cue cases and Facebook doesn't care.
Yeah.
So basically it's left to the business, me, to deal with it. It's left to consumers to be careful. But you know, when you have a combination of a trusted seller like myself, where I have a name brand and I'm active, then people just jump at these offers. And lately they don't even offer them at too good to be true prices anymore. They're like getting full price on products that they don't even have.
So the customers are getting scammed, and then are they coming back on you and blaming you, and you just have to explain to them? Or
so that's only happened two or three times.
Yeah,
when they've done that, but I think it's probably happened, you know, more than that in groups that that I'm not a part of. One customer reported us to the Better Business Bureau, and I got a message. And so I called the Better Business Bureau. I said, hey, that's not us. I called the customer, and then he retracted it at the Better Business Bureau. And then as soon as I called the customer, he said, oh, you know, I knew it. You know, and I thought to myself, well, if you knew it, then, you know, why didn't you try to contact us then before you, you know, went straight to the Better Business Bureau? But I understand people are emotional and they're upset. You know, nobody likes to get scammed for a couple hundred dollars or 800. And some of these have been, you know, pretty decent sized. Like, I got into a conversation with one of these scammers who tried to extort me. He offered to stop scamming, stop impersonating me for $5,000. And it was a ridiculous conversation, you know, and he was literally posting screenshots of the victims. You know, one of them was $800. He posted $2,000 worth of screenshots that he had taken off of people. And I said to him, I said, so you expect me to honestly believe that if I give you $5,000, you're going to stop taking this easy money?
Yeah.
You know, so they try to get it both ways. So what I want to do is I had Chandler do a little bit of research for me, and I want to kind of run down a few of these, the main techniques that people are using.
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Absolutely. Lay it on us.
So the number one type of scam that people do is called phishing. I'm pretty sure at this point a lot of people have heard of phishing. It's spelled PH. I don't know why, but basically it's like phishing. You're casting a line, trying to hook a fish. And the way it works is they're trying to steal your information. So that usually comes in the form of an unsolicited email or text or somebody pretending to be a utility or something like that, trying to get you to type in your information. Or they're trying to install malware or something or a virus on your computer if you click on the link. And there's a lot of people that fall for this because the better that they craft these emails, the more official it looks. People just click on the link and the virus is in your computer in a matter of seconds.
So I've dealt with those as a business owner a couple times. Specifically, I will get DocuSign stuff come to me, or Google, Adobe Sign, stuff like that will come to my email, and I wouldn't be expecting it. So I never have clicked on it. But one time they did get me. I was expecting a DocuSign from another agreement that I needed to sign, and they happened to send one at a similar time frame as I was expecting it, and I clicked, and it infected my whole computer. I ended up transferring I had my data saved on a backup drive. I just destroyed the computer and got it on a new one. I didn't know what else to do at that point because we have too much sensitive information, you know. So
no, that's exactly what can happen, you know. And there's so many ways that they can do this. They will infect your computer sometimes and just use your computer as part of a botnet.
Yep.
So they'll use your computer's resources. You'll notice your computer's getting slower, but it's because they're using your computer to send out more of these phishing emails and these attacks. So that's one way. Then the other way is they encrypt your data, and then they hold it for ransom. The other way is obviously they just steal all your identity that they can get off there, or they log your keystrokes. So if you're going to your official bank app, for example, on your computer, and you type in your password and email, well, they're logging that and you're transmitting everything to these crooks. So you got to be really aware of phishing. Now on turtlesmith.com, we are going to have a comprehensive guide on how to avoid these things, you know, so give you some really good tips about how to make sure that URLs are the safe, you know, that are the correct place to go, how to look up things, you know, and find out if they were scams, you know, or likely to be a scam. The number two thing that comes up is identity theft. This is one where people just impersonate someone else. So a lot of times people will get a text or something and they will say, hey, seeming like it's coming from your brother or your sister or whatever. And I'll say, hey, you know, I'm in jail, or, you know, I need bail, or, you know, my car broke down or something. Can you send me, you know, $300 real quick? Stuff like that. So that's a low level form of it. But, you know, a higher level form of it is obviously, you know, they get your credit card information, they open up accounts in your name and so on. So that's something that, you know, unfortunately, a lot of us are probably going to have to use, like, the services that will monitor that monitor your credits and everything and make sure no one's opening accounts in your name.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something though, along those lines. So one of the things that I've seen is people will actually take or attempt to take someone else's house by selling their house, you know.
That's actually happened a bunch of times. There's a real famous story. I maybe Calvin can bring it up for us, but there's actually a funny one where a guy sold the Eiffel Tower. He sold it twice in a scam. There was a time when the Eiffel Tower was kind of an eyesore and the French people didn't really like it. And so there were rumors that they were going to scrap it and tear it down for scrap metal. And so a guy sold it to a foreign government saying that, you know, he was a member of the French government and that they were going to sell it. So that's a scam that's been going on for a long time.
I almost feel like that anybody that bought the Eiffel Tower kind of deserved it.
Yeah, there is. Victor Lustig, a con artist. He sold the Eiffel Tower twice in a scam. But that's, I just bring that up because that's a scam that's been going on for a long time, you know.
So. Well, I mean, you know, and the thing of it is that humans have, you know, a real large capacity for deceit and cleverness. There are some cultures around the world where they actually revere the trickster.
Yeah.
You know, and they feel like that if someone is a victim of a scam, it's actually the victim's fault, you know, for falling for it, because they feel like it's human nature to try and trick other people. And therefore the onus should be on the person who's the intended victim to protect themselves.
And I feel like that in today's world is absolute bullcrap, because there's so much stigma in just admitting that you got scammed that you don't want to, and people don't learn and they don't ask for help.
Right.
So I hope that people realize that these scams, even though they sound silly sometimes, like, you know, don't fall for the Nigerian prince, you know, offering you money, that old Gmail one that used to go around. But if you feel like you're getting scammed, just ask. Ask people, reach out, you know, talk to your bank even, and just double check that these things aren't horrible scams.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, the other part of human nature is, so in pool, right, and this actually goes beyond pool, you know, it's just in con artistry and hustling and so on, is that there's an adage there that you can't steal from an honest man.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people who fall for these things are thinking that they themselves are getting over on the other person. So there's a little bit of larceny in their heart too. But, you know, if it's just something like, you know, like my cases, for example, you know, you say a case costs $300 and one comes up and somebody says, hey, I got a JB case for $250, right? That's not that much off, but it's enough, you know, to make you think, oh, you know what? I've been wanting one of these for a while and I'm happy to save $50, and you'll just send somebody the money, especially if you think that they're me, you know?
Yeah.
And it just happens in a moment, you know, just without really thinking. So it's unfortunate that people have to get, you know, cynical and jaded and protective, but that's the way it is, especially when these tech companies absolutely 100% have the means to stop a lot of these people because the patterns are so easy, and they don't, then it really even more now becomes, because it becomes easier to do these things for the scammers. So now the onus is even more on the victims, you know, the intended victims. So, go ahead.
Before you move on to the next one, I do want to talk a little bit more about the identity theft. There are a bunch of programs out there that you had mentioned. Definitely try to get those, especially if you're starting a business. But one thing that really falls into my world of accounting and taxes a lot, there are a ton of identity theft for tax returns. People will file tax returns with your Social Security and your name, claiming huge refunds, and they get that money.
How can you protect yourself against that?
So the best way to protect yourself on that is to file your taxes every year. The way that they get people is that sometimes you don't have a filing requirement. So if you know, maybe didn't work for a couple of years, or you worked a little bit, but not enough to require one, or if you're just not paying attention to your taxes, people will file and they won't notice for a long time. You know, the IRS can take 3 or 4, maybe even 5 years to actually review a return. There are some limitations depending on how much you got, but They have some time, and so they don't do it right away. And they might file 2, 3, 4 years of tax returns under your Social Security and your name, getting huge refunds. And then the IRS is coming at you like, hey, you owe all this money.
So let me ask you something. If you file a return, right? So the deadline is April 15th for regular working people, right? So you file a return sometime between January and April 15th. And then they go in and file a return also in that same period of time. Does the IRS have any way to know which one is correct?
So more often than not, you e-file nowadays. So I have a program that I e-file them. A lot of people use like TurboTax and that kind of stuff. When you file your tax return, if there's one already on file, it rejects the return. And so they say, we already have a tax return on file for this Social Security number and name. You know it right then, and it's much easier to fix in the current tax year. So if you're filing before April 15th, even if you file on the last day, you find out that there's a tax return already filed, it's much easier to resolve that issue quickly rather than 2 or 3 years later when you finally notice.
Now, would it be sensible for the government, for example, to allow taxpayers to create a PIN number, for example?
So they have what's called an ID PIN. It's a ID protection PIN. Actually, Calvin, can you look that up for us? And I'll find out exactly. You can go to irs.gov and you can actually get a PIN number for you. They mail it to you and it protects your identity. You cannot file your tax returns without it. It's called an identity protection PIN, an IP PIN. I'm sorry.
Now, can the scammers get that?
They cannot. If you have that IP PIN that's associated with your Social Security number, I believe it changes every year. They send you a new PIN number. Mm-hmm. And so unless they intercepted your mail or you didn't get it or something, they can't file. So it's an extra level of security. The other thing I want to mention too is it's really great to file tax returns for your children once they become teenagers or if they ever start working or their Social Security starts to get out there. So for example, your kids, we will start filing returns for them. Even if we just file 0 returns, at least they're on something and a return has been filed. And that way nobody can steal their identities.
Now, is there a way for the scammers to know whether you have filed a tax return or not?
So if you have filed a return or if you have this IP PIN, what'll happen is if they try to file it and you have an IP PIN, their return will get rejected saying you can't be filed because we don't have an IP PIN. And if you have already filed a tax return and they try to file one later, theirs will also get rejected. So a lot of ways to
say that I understand, but what I'm saying is like, let's say that they have my Social Security number. Mm-hmm. Are they able to look up whether or not I have filed?
Oh, yes. Yes, you can. On irs.gov, you can look up refund statuses and check and those kind of things. There are other ways to get about it, but having that IP PIN is very great and making sure you file.
Can they look
return.
It up just by having the Social Security number?
Sometimes, yeah, depending on a few different factors. They can always fill out paperwork, try to get that information. It's hard to do, but there are scammers who have done that.
And is it fairly easy to get the IP PIN?
It's very easy. You just go on, you fill out all your information, and they'll mail it to you.
Okay, so at turtlesmith.com, we're going to have that information for you guys.
Definitely a great place to go.
And we're going to really hammer that home that you should go protect yourself.
And file your tax return. So
yes,
you don't want to get behind if you can, because that's when the scammers get you. When you fall way behind, they'll get a bunch of money out of you. And then you end up having to pay somebody like me a bunch of money to fix it. And it really stinks.
So, and is it fixable?
It is fixable. It is. It's all very fixable, but it can be a hassle. I got a good story for you. One of our clients, I may have told this before, but she's 20 years old. She filed her very first tax return because she finally made some money. A scammer had stolen her identity and filed several years of false tax returns already. This was the first time she qualified for it. And they filed to get the earned income credit, stating that she had a child. And she's 20. The child is listed as 13 years old.
Oh, my God.
And it took us 3 phone calls to the IRS, which is about 6 to 8 hours of work for my attorney, on hold, talking to people, to convince the IRS that a 20-year-old did not have a 13-year-old child.
Your government at work, folks.
It just, and it's not their fault. They have procedures. They have to verify and all that. And it has to get escalated to a supervisor who can actually make the decision. So we had to charge for all of that. And so this poor 20-year-old woman who, very first time she ever had a tax return done, she gets screwed.
And she just didn't know, right?
Nope.
Somebody out there is collecting money from the government on her behalf.
It's a huge scam.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is another reason why I think that we need to have more public-private partnerships. You know, there are coders out there, for example, that will volunteer their time for government agencies. They'll do it for municipalities and things like that, where their basic premise is, let's make this work better.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we need more of that. Now, having said that, you know, that particular story, you know, it sounds like Facebook is teaching the IRS how to deal with scammers.
Well, it's unfortunate. Know, which is not. But, you know, the IRS also has to do a lot of returns. They're underfunded. There's a lot of reasons, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, what's the next one?
So the next one is brand hijacking. So I'm dealing with that as well. And this one is a big one, especially on Facebook. So anyone can create a website. They can use your logo. They can use your trademarks. Anyone can create a page on Facebook and do this. And it is incredibly difficult to report these guys and get anything done with this. Even if you own the trademark and you have all the information and everything, it's very difficult. If I want to, for example, dispute a website that is using a trademark, a domain name that is substantially similar to mine. So in this case, it's JB-cases instead of jbcases.com. It cost me $3,000 just to file the dispute.
Yeah.
You know, so they make this just incredibly prohibitively expensive for small businesses. I don't have a good answer as to that right now, how to fight that. One way we're going to do it on Facebook is we're going to just, every one of these that we find, we started a document, and we're just going to put a big old, you know, scammer right on the, like a rubber stamp, you know, like the old style red rubber stamp. We're putting it on there, and then we're just going to post it to every group every time we find these guys. And that, again, that takes up our time, right? It's frustrating. But it's part of what we have to do as customer service to protect ourselves and protect our customers, our potential customers.
You know, on the trademark deal, my brother, he has the company of Turtle Wines. He actually got an email saying that somebody was trying to register that brand in like the state of Maryland or something. And he's like, no, I have the trademark. But they had emailed him saying that somebody else was trying to do it. And we sent it to our attorneys. And it turned out to be a whole scam. This whole scam company saying that people are trying to register trademarks, and then you email them back, and then they want you to pay a fortune for them to re-register it for you. So in this scenario, always just call your people. Don't engage with those scammers. Talk to your network of whoever, or look at Turtlesmith, and hopefully we'll have the info.
Well, the thing with that is that, you know, this goes back to what we've been talking about all the things that a small business owner has to contend with already. You know, you already have all the compliance, and you already have all of the niggly things that you want to do, right? The small, tiny, whatever, just daily tasks and annoyances and everything that you have to take care of to keep your business running. And then you get hit with crap like that on top of it, and you get scared.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to react emotionally. So that is a very good piece of advice, is just whenever anything like that comes across your desk, comes in your email or whatever, just take a moment, take a breath, step back. Even if you don't have somebody, if you are somebody who did your own trademark, for example, which, you know, you can do that. Take the time to type in the name of the company, for example, and look them up and see if they're legitimate. And because 99 times out of 10, other people will have experienced this, and people who have guys who have trademark lawyers and so on, they will have experienced it, and they will have shared their experience online and let people know about this type of scam. But we will have at Turtlesmith, again, you know, we're going to have a pretty comprehensive, instruction sheet and a video on how to deal with this.
We're going to do our best to get as many as we can. And we hope that the community will send us stuff so that we can keep putting that online so that more people can find.
Oh, absolutely. It's
going
to, be an ever evolving, ever growing resource.
We hope so. Yeah.
And we can only hope that, you know, it goes viral enough where, it makes life incredibly difficult for scammers and you know, just makes it very uncomfortable for them and they won't have any place to ply their trade.
Yeah.
Fake invoices. So they'll impersonate a company or a contractor requesting payment for services and products. This happens a lot. You know, they'll send in an invoice. They'll say, you owe this. And a lot of people will just hit the button and pay. So this can be, the scam there could be just as simple as you just pay an invoice that doesn't exist and you lose that money. Or it could be even worse, where not only do you pay, you also give them your credit card information. And then they take that and, you know, go on a shopping spree and duplicate your card and put it on the dark web and so on. So very, very important to know, really have a handle on what's coming in, and don't just pay something immediately. You know, the world will not end if you don't pay an invoice right away. So if you don't recognize it in any way, shape or form, if you're not 100% sure that you know that it's right and it just comes into your email box, there's a real good chance it's probably a scam.
And you always want to really double check the ones that say you must pay immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Most companies run on a net 10 or net 30 or even net 60 type of deal. So you have plenty of time to pay most bills. So if things are coming in hot and they're like, you have to pay immediately, oftentimes it can be a problem. Unless, of course, you were late on something already.
So another one like that I've heard about is that happened to me, you know, a couple times is I've gotten a couple emails where they've said, the IRS, you know, you owe the IRS so much money, you mm-hmm. know. Now for me, right, when I came to you, I did owe the IRS money because I just hadn't filed my taxes in a couple of years. Like, we had the money, it was sitting there, so we hadn't spent it, but I knew that we needed to, you know, have it all booked and accounted correctly, you know, and all the proper deductions and everything. So obviously I wanted a pro to do it. But as I've mentioned a few times, you know, the first thing I said to you when I walked in is, can you keep me out of jail? You know, because yeah. I didn't know what the rules are on that. I don't know. Is the IRS going to show up at my door someday and say, this is our house now?
Yeah.
And so, you know, a couple times when these emails have come into my box and they said, you know, and they're so brazen, they'll say things like, you know, we're literally sending the sheriff to your house. And now I had enough sense, you know, to know that this is, you know, just the way that it was written and everything, it's just real scammy and scummy and that it wasn't right. But, you know, I feel like that there's probably people out there that get caught in this. And
100%.
You know, so, you know, I know that there's stories out there where people get caught with stuff like that, you know, where they feel like they have to pay right then.
One of the big ones I want to mention is the IRS will never call you unless you are expecting a phone call. So there's a lot of times where people will get phone calls from the IRS and they'll say, you owe 10 grand. And if you don't pay it today, you're going to jail. We're sending officers. Just like you had mentioned, you know, they were going to send the sheriffs up. The IRS will always send multiple letters and notices and stuff like that. And then eventually, if you keep dodging them, an agent will actually show up and speak to you in person. But rarely they will call you.
So what you're saying then is that I should not use those letters to hold up my table and I should actually open them and take action.
Or just bring them to an accountant. Right. but yeah, I really want to do hammer home the point that the IRS doesn't call, because there's a lot of clients, unfortunately, that have walked through my door who have got that phone call. They said, if you don't pay this amount of money, you're going to jail. People assume that if you owe money to the IRS, that eventually you end up in jail. And that does happen sometimes. So it makes it even more scary. And a lot of those people got scammed. And I've known specifically some clients. I've told you the story in private. I won't mention it here. But there's a few clients that I've worked with who have paid just fortunes to scammers because they thought they were going to jail. And they still owe all those taxes. The IRS doesn't let you write it off. So you're just giving all your money away. And then you still owe a bunch more.
Yeah. So that's an important one right there. You don't get to write off being scammed as a business expense.
No. No, you do not.
So it pays to be careful.
And one of the best ways you can protect yourself is get an accountant or a bookkeeper or just a second set of eyes.
So is that an ad we should make for you?
It like really
somebody
is.
Gets the call, you know, and really, at the end of it, it's like if you don't want the sheriff to show up, you know,
if you hang
come
up
to S&H Business,
if
Services.
You hang up and you call me, my first sentence is that's bullshit. It's wrong. You're fine. So you'll come in, we'll get some paperwork filled out, we'll figure out what's actually going on. But if you get that phone call and say, hey, the IRS called me and said I'm going to jail if I don't pay this money, is this true? I go, no, that's not true.
We should play around with that and role play some commercials like that.
There you go.
There we go. We're talking about making accounting fun. At least let's make it, you know, where we can take some of the fear out of it when people get those calls.
Yeah. What's the next one?
So the next one is a directory listing. Okay. So this one is the scam here is that you get a promise of being put on a non-existent or private directory or online listing that actually isn't rendering any services.
Yep.
So that one I haven't personally come across. So I guess that one to me sounds a little bit like maybe they're just trying to get you to pay some money for the service, but they don't actually ever render the service.
I get the phone call 5 times a day that my Google listing is being searched by customers, but they can't find me. I need to call to verify my information. You call to verify, and then they say, well, we can put you on this list, you know, top Google search for $500 a month or whatever it is. It's all bullshit.
Okay. I get that call too, but I've never actually called them. So, you know, I just go online and go to Google and
I called to try to get them off because they were calling me 5 times a day. I was getting exhausted. I was like, take me off. So I just started blocking the numbers every time they come in, but they just keep using different ones. So,
and that's another thing, you know, is with the amount of scam numbers, with the way that they're able to use the phone system today and clone numbers and make it these days. I screen a lot of my calls, you know, because it says possible scam. Mm-hmm. But now these guys are so good, they just a phone number says Oklahoma City,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think it's the city of Oklahoma City and they want to take me to jail. So no, I'm kidding. But okay, fake checks. Okay. This one is will come in the form of an overpayment. Scammer will ask you to wire back the difference. And then when the check bounces, you're on the hook for the amount of what you wired. I'm going to say on that one that I'm not real up to speed on that. I kind of know what it is. This one is sort of like the call center scams, you know, when they call, they're calling people and they're saying, hey, I'm going to overpay you this. And then you send me the overpayment back and so on. But I'm going to say that we'll probably flesh that one out a little bit more on the website, figure out all the different ways that we can research about exactly how this goes down. So you'll understand the steps and when you recognize these methods, then you'll know that to avoid it. This one is the next one is something that John Oliver on the what is his show? Last Week Tonight,
mm-hmm.
did a segment on, and I hadn't heard of this before, but it's called pig butchering. This is a long con. They will play a character that just happened to or accidentally contacted you, so like a wrong number. And then they'll play it off being a friendly voice until you start to trust them. So they'll just start conversing with you.
Yeah.
And then they can, you know, the idea is that they want to gain your trust so they can get you to do what they want. So this is typically creating an account on some sort of app, like they're going to try to bring you in on a crypto deal or something. It's, oh, you know, hey, by the way, you know, I got this really cool deal, you know, and you seem like a cool person. You want to come in with me on it? You know, that sort of thing. And apparently this one happens over like weeks or months even, you know, so they really play a long game with this to get your trust and mm-hmm. they have a lot of conversation.
Yeah, I've had that happen to me. I get the phone call. It's like, hello, is this Ann or something? And then I'm like, nope, wrong number. And they're like, oh, well, you seem nice. Sorry about that. How's your day going? And then if you keep talking to them, they'll just keep talking and they'll send pictures of like pretty young girls and stuff sometimes. And then they'll, you know, say, oh, you seem nice, we should meet up and stuff like that. Or, you know, and then they start telling me about these other websites and stuff. I played with them a little bit just to see what happened, but I knew they were scams right away.
Yeah, that's, you know, I get that sometimes as random private messages from people that I don't even know. And I never really interact with these people, you know, but I imagine that's probably something along those lines.
I get the text now on my work phone. It just says hello. And I go, hello, who's this? You know, just because I thought maybe it's a client. And then they hit me with like the, you know, political node or the crypto or whatever, some kind of service offer. It's really annoying.
So number 8 on this list is social engineering. So this one is more of a method than a scam itself. Typically, we'll gather information about someone or a business that typically will create vulnerabilities. Someone calling support and making small talk with customer support and lowering the employee's guard. And thus they get information that they shouldn't, like where they eat lunch at, so the scammer can skim their ID badge.
Oh, yeah.
I think this one is more along the lines of things that might happen to corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much about small businesses. However, it can happen to small businesses because, you know, even in small businesses, we have information that we don't necessarily want other people to have.
Well, and depending on what kind of industry you're in, too, you might have valuable goods or raw materials and stuff that are needed by scammers or thieves or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. They might call you up just trying to find out, you know, how many hot water tanks you have that have a particular, you know, thing in it, or catalytic converters or something. So, you know, the idea there with that number 8 is just train your employees, for example, to be very careful and not reveal a lot. My wife is always on my ass because I am an oversharer online.
Only going to make it worse right here.
Well, I'll just let things, you know, slip out of my mouth, you know, and she'll be like, why in the world did you tell everybody that?
Yeah.
You know, learn to keep things to yourself and learn to teach your employees how to keep things to themselves. Don't share any information that is sensitive. And, you know, think about what information actually is sensitive and identify that and teach them how to be careful. So there was another one that I wanted to say. Oh, like on Facebook these days, you'll see people like lately I've been looking for cars for a friend of mine, you know, to try to get him a cheap, reliable car. And so one thing that's been happening a lot is you'll get a car. You'll say, hey, is a car available? Can I come see it? And they'll say things like, there's two methods of this. One is they will say, I just posted that car for my sister. If you want more information, you know, send an email to this email. So I guess they're just kind of harvesting your email, I suppose. And then I don't know if a further conversation ensues because I've never sent them an email.
You got to have the burner email. You have a burner email?
I have, but I don't remember them, you know, but you're right. By the way, you know, a good way to get a burner email or a lot of burner emails, a lot of people don't know this little trick, is, you can go register a domain.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a super cheap, monthly, account somewhere.
Yeah.
And you can set up what's called a catch-all box. So that catches all the email that comes in. So if it's like say it's john@jbcases.com, right? Let's say that I go sign up for a website or something, you know, like redpill.com.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll sign up an email there and I'll say redpill@jbcases.com.
Oh, okay.
Right? So that'll go into my catch-all box.
Gotcha.
So it's anything@jbcases.com. So you basically set up just a dummy .com email or any kind of website, could be .edu, .org, whatever, right? And then you set up your catch-all box. So from that moment on, you can type anything into any email field and put it in as an email at any site. So this is also something that's good just for signing up at places that you want to try something, but you don't necessarily want them to have your real email.
I didn't know you could do that. That's really clever. So we should have some information on that.
We will. I'll show you on that. So I've gotten out of that habit because I stopped a couple of years ago. I stopped managing our own email.
Yeah.
But it's super easy actually to manage your own email on some of these sites, and we'll have information on that as far as and tutorials. So what are some of the impacts of this? You know, so over 10 billion reported losses from consumers. That's the reported losses, okay? So you mentioned earlier that a lot of people are just embarrassed and don't want to report it. And so a lot of times they're just embarrassed and they don't admit it. So this is probably wildly underreported.
Yeah.
31% of small businesses were victims of check fraud. 88% lost more than $25,000. 65% lost more than $50,000. Cyber attacks against small businesses ratcheted up by just over 60% in the last 2 years. 43% were first time. A recent Verif survey, I've never heard of them, Verif, but had nearly 90% of respondents say they had up to 9% of their revenue lost due to fraud. 9%, 10% of your revenue, you know? That's like, you know, there was a time when we were making like $100,000-$150,000 a year. We were barely making payroll every week.
That would have killed you.
$15,000 of my money gone, you know, and I can't pay my people and I can't, you know, I mean, there were weeks where I just barely had enough to make payroll, you know, where me and Lulu went without.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would have devastated us. So 87% report a rise in online fraud as of April 2024. Only 1.19% reported no fraud attempts in a month. Think about that. Only 1% of people reporting said that they didn't have anybody trying to defraud them.
That's pretty ridiculous.
You know? And you know, so basically, look, I had a last year I actually got scammed. Well, I didn't quite get scammed. Because I saw somebody was posting a machine that I wanted, and it was about half the price of the machine normally. And so I said to the guy, I said, you know, when you know how much, you know, how can I pay you and so on. So he told me his PayPal account. So I paid him PayPal goods and services. So for those of you who use PayPal, that means that that. The person receiving the money is going to have to pay a 3% fee. It's a business service, but it also means that there's protection for the buyer.
Yeah.
As opposed to what's called PayPal friends and family.
Right. Right.
And friends and family is basically like handing somebody cash. And again, this is where I say that, you know, PayPal should be in this situation, you know, they should have like, you know, checks and double checks on here and say if they should hold the money. And sometimes they do. You know, I had a friend of mine who sold a queue for $24,000, went through PayPal, and they actually held the money for 30 days. So my friend couldn't get his money. But, you know, sometimes they protect like that, and then a lot of times they don't. Most times they don't. So anyway, the guy got mad at me because I sent it goods and services because he asked for it friends and family. But I just had that feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know the guy. So, you know, I'm not going to send somebody I don't know just handing them cash over the internet. Well, he got mad, you know, and says, why did you send it this way and yada, yada. And I said, I sent it because I want to protect myself because I want to make sure I get the lathe, you know? Well, I would never do this to you. And I promise on you know, my ancestors and all this stuff, you know, when you start to see the language, you start to understand how this goes. You know, and on my honor and everything. So finally we got around to the point where, you know, he knew that I knew that he was a scammer. And then he was like, you know, you're just too greedy. He goes, you know, what does it matter to you if you lose $400? You know, for me, it's a big deal. I feed my family, you know. And I was like, dude, if you put like a quarter of the energy into a regular legal, you know, ethical endeavor, you'd probably make so much more money than you do scamming, you know? And this goes around and around. But that's how they feel about it, a lot of these guys, you know? And then the other side of it is, going back to the pig butchering and John Oliver segment, it turns out that a lot of those guys are themselves victims of scams. They went and applied for what they thought was a legitimate tech job, and they end up getting basically imprisoned and enslaved into this scamming operation, where they can't leave their family. They're threatened that their families will be harmed and so on like that. So it just makes the whole thing even worse.
Yeah.
And, but you know, at the end of the day, we have to protect ourselves. So at Turtle Smith, we want to give you all the resources that we can to build a strong business. And we want to give you all the resources that we can to protect your business.
Well, and some people out there may think that they're not going to get scammed or that they won't have to bother with it. I guarantee that every single person who starts a new business and registers an LLC will be the victim of a fraud attempt within about 2 weeks.
Oh, absolutely.
And the reason is because you're going to receive in the mail, once you sign up with your LLC, you will receive in the mail a letter that says certified letter of good standing for LLC. It is a scam. And I don't know how they get away with it, but in the teeny tiny fine print at the very bottom of the letter, it says not affiliated with your state secretary of state. It is basically you pay them $150 and you get in a nice little frame your certificate of good standing that they just printed from the Secretary of State's website and put in a frame. And it cost them $20 and you paid $150 for it. It is not a necessary thing to do. You've already paid for your LLC. It's already registered. It's a scam letter and people fall for it every day.
Well, and the same thing happens with trademarks, as we talked about earlier. You know, the main thing to remember is that human cleverness can be used to advance society, and it can be used to scam society. And there's no shortage of people on both sides of this that are looking for ways to use their brain to help people and ways to use their brain to hurt people.
Yeah.
You know, intelligence has no morals.
100%. Well, I hope this was a good, like, little introduction to scams. Do you have any further thoughts or any more you want to share?
I have a lot of thoughts. So I would like to speak directly to Mark Zuckerberg. You can do better. And that's the nicest way I can say it.
Yeah, that would seem pretty polite. I thought we were going to have to get some cussing there. So
yeah. Well, you know, I'm trying not to turn off you know, half our audience right away.
Fair enough. Well, I understand you were dealing with that kind of tough. What was it, the cloning scams? That's what you're dealing with.
It's horrible. You can't imagine. You cannot imagine that how these guys are doing it. Like, we literally caught one of them in the act of taking one of their fake car parts pages and transforming it into a JB Cases page.
Yeah.
I mean, it's terrible because you could see it, right? You could see where he changed, you know, the name, the title, the part of the page said, you know, Car Parts International, and then the other part of it said JB Cases. And then you could scroll down and see all the car parts that he had for offer. And then you know, the newest posts were JB Cases for offer.
Yeah.
You know, so you could see him kind of transitioning into this. And Facebook, you know, they really won't do anything about it. I'm paying them $20 a month at this point for a verified badge,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty worthless. But the only thing that I get with this verified badge that's of any use whatsoever is the ability to chat with someone at Facebook, the lowest possible level employee I think that can exist at Facebook, that has access to a computer is who I'm chatting with.
Yeah.
And all that person does is go, oh, I'm really sorry that you're dealing with this. You know, let me report this to the internal team. And then the internal team does nothing, you know. And it is, it itself is a scam, in my opinion, you know.
Fair enough.
And you have to literally go through like six menus to get to the chat part.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a whole video on that. So if you guys want to see the uncensored version of how I really feel about all this, I would suggest you go to the authentic JB Cases page on Facebook and look for my video on this. And me and alcohol will be telling the truth about how awful Facebook is and how they allow, in my opinion, how they allow members to be scammed when they obviously have the technology to stop it.
I feel like you're going to get our whole enterprise canceled before we even start.
Listen, if Facebook if Facebook wants to come after us on that,
yeah,
then I will, that Lulu will allow into fighting
good,
Facebook.
That's the good caveat, which Lulu will allow.
So, but I really do honestly believe, you know, and if Facebook wants to come after us on that, I would love to go to court and have discovery going on that.
Fair enough, man. Well, I think that's it for scams on this episode. Definitely check out theturtlesmith.com. We'll try to have a whole listing of these different scams, and we hope to add a bunch to it. And if you in the community have any scams that you've fell for or want to let us know about, definitely hit us up.
Absolutely. Yeah, let us know. Let us know in email. You know, that'll be an easier way for us to get it. Sometimes we don't look at all the comments.
Yeah.
But you know, absolutely put it in comments for the other users and members and everything. 100%. And any of our groups or anything, you know, feel free to go to there. Go to any of our communities that we have going. The more information that we have, the more we share it, the harder it is for these guys to operate.
Absolutely. And don't feel bad if you fell for one. Everybody's fallen for at least a little something. So this podcast is brought to you by S&H Business Services. We are serving the OKC and greater Oklahoma area. We offer tax preparation, accounting, bookkeeping, and payroll services for small businesses and individuals. You can find us at shbusinessservices.com. Again, that's S&H Business Services, found at shbusinessservices.com.
Yeah, I feel like we should end this on something positive.
Oh, okay.
So is there anything that, like a book or anything, or anything that you want to talk about? That?
Oh, for our next segment, you want to talk about, this book we can talk about. Let me grab it. Hold on.
Show us the book.
It's pretty good.
Continuing education is very important as a small business owner.
100%, man. I try to read as much of these as I can. I just read this one. It's by Michael Gerber, The E-Myth Enterprise, How to Turn a Great Idea into a Thriving Business. I thought it was pretty good. There's a bunch of really good information in here on branding and, you know, how to kind of get your business going. But he's real, you know, pro free market. But one of the two things that he talked about, and I had never, I mean, I had thought about it before, but I've never really quantified it, I guess, as good as I could. And this is a quote directly from his book. He says, to succeed, every business in a free market system must learn how to satisfy, better than its competitors, the essential needs, unconscious expectations, and perceived preferences of the four most important groups of people in its business universe. And I didn't think about the four most important people. That is the people who work for the company, the people who buy from your company, the people who sell to it, and the people who lend to it. And I never had thought about all four of those in kind of one thought process, but it is really important. Your employees, your customers, your suppliers, and your lenders. You have to pay attention to all four of those.
I don't disagree with any of that. And I think that a lot of us fall short on some of those. Out in Vegas a couple of years ago, Don and I took a tour of Zappos. You ever heard of them?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So at Zappos, you know, they have a couple interesting things that they do. One of them is every employee is highly empowered to make the customer happy. And that, in turn, makes the employee happy that they have that ability. So, you know, happier employees, happier customer service, and so on. But the other thing that I found that was really interesting that they do there is after a month, and I don't know if they still do this, but say they take on a new hire, that new hire will work there for a month. And then after a month, they will poll the team that they're working with, and they will ask the team if they want to keep them. And then they will offer the employee $1,000 to quit.
That's really interesting.
You know, so they will say, look, if you don't feel like you're a good fit at Zappos, then take the $1,000 and, you know, we wish you well.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty ballsy. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a really good move because it really helps to have a really cohesive team where they feel empowered and involved in who that team is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know how they deal with their lenders. Jeff Bezos bought them, so I don't think they have lenders anymore.
Well, I mean, as a small business, the perception that these different people have may be different as well. You know, I mean, the perception that your customers have may not be the same perception that your lenders have. Mm-hmm. So I always thought about, you know, you just want to have your business be good all around, you know, have good financials, be a good, strong business, and everything kind of takes care of itself. But to really think about the perception of all these different people and how they view your company as a whole and making sure that your company does, you know, for lack of a better word, market itself to not only your customers, but to your employees and vendors and lenders, it was a good thought. I never had quantified it before.
So no, that's what I think it is good. And I think the, you know, the lenders part of it is possibly the most difficult part of all that.
It is.
You know, I can tell you that, you know, at times when we were doing really well, I felt like we were invisible to banks. I felt like that a lot of small businesses honestly couldn't care less what we make.
Mm-hmm.
All they cared about was whether I could over collateralize anything that I wanted.
Yeah.
It's not even the right way to say that. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, you know, developing a relationship with people that lend to you, making sure that they feel like you have good character, you have a good product, you know, and so on, or they at least understand it. That goes back also to networking, because now, through you, for example, and through some of the contacts that we've made in the banks and stuff, now we know that for example, a lender can be a hub for bringing people together.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
so they're essentially, if they bring two businesses together, they're basically vouching for both of those businesses to each of those other businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yep. 100%. So this book goes into pretty good detail on some branding ideas as well, which we're actually going to get into in the step of branding, which you'll find in a later episode. But there's one other thing I really wanted to highlight from this book that I thought was very interesting. It gets very detailed into process-oriented companies versus people-oriented companies. And very often you'll hear people say, I can't find anybody good. You know, hiring good help is very difficult. And this book, when I was reading through that, it really made me think about, is it actually the people that are failing, or is it the processes of your company that are failing? Theoretically, depending on what kind of industry it is, I mean, obviously for accountants or lawyers or a writer, you have to have a good person. But if you have a business where an employee is, you know, doing a daily task or a retail job or something like that, if their processes are not rock solid, it doesn't matter who you hire. They're going to be trash in that position. So if you're failing at a certain task in your business, rather than complain, hey, I can't find any good help, maybe it's, I haven't nailed down the processes enough for this company to be successful.
Yeah, I'll say that that's, I will say that that's definitely been a problem in my company, because we're so specialized. We've got so many little details on custom cases.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we bring somebody in, we don't have like a manual, for example, you know, even after all this time, we don't have a set of frequently asked questions for even our employees to refer to.
And that makes it real tough to run a business. I know you struggle with hiring sometimes, right?
Yeah, of course. And but a lot of that is because I'm, you know, like you said, I'm hiring and we hire good people. And those good people struggle because customers are asking questions that they just absolutely do not know the answers to. And then they've constantly got to talk to Lulu or myself. Or I'll just be sitting there listening, you know, they'll be taking a call, and I can only hear half the call, of course, but I can hear that they're struggling, you know, I can guess, you know, what the questions are that they're being asked by the way that they're struggling to answer, and then I'll have to kind of butt in on the call and take it over to answer the customer. And I do consider that to be a failure on my part. Something that, you know, we will be correcting now that I've taken the step to hire an assistant that will help me to organize these things. But yes, I fully can attest to the fact that not having a good process will ruin a good person.
Well, and it can ruin a business if your business can only function if you have very good or certain people. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes you can't get away from it, you know, depending on what kind of business that you're doing, you can't get away from having to hire specific people with specific skills, and they have to be good at what they do. But as much as possible, if you can eliminate the people factor and make sure that your business can run smoothly just on the processes that you put together, meaning you could literally put anybody in a job and the job's still getting done, That's a recipe for success right there.
It can be, I think. You know, I've got two examples of that mm-hmm. I'd like to impart really quickly.
Yeah.
So one of them is a story that I read about, I want to say a Korean auto parts distributor, might have been Vietnamese. But they were really struggling with illiteracy. Mm-hmm. So when an order would come in, there would be a lot of mistakes because a lot of the people that they hired, they realized these folks can't read.
Yeah.
So they switched up the whole way that they catalog everything, and they made everything pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And their failure rate on orders, you know, on mistakes on orders, went down to something like less than 1%. Because of that, so people could go through and they in this giant warehouse, and they could pick the parts easily, and they learned by memory, you know, where these parts were, and boom, they got them.
Yeah.
So that's one thing, you know, where you might think, okay, well, why don't you just teach everybody to read, right? Well, I'm sure that they probably, you know, wanted to do that as well, but it was much easier to change the process to fit the people.
Yeah.
Another one is there's a book called 2 Second Lean, mm-hmm, by a guy named Paul Acker.
Yep.
Paul Akers. And he has a business where he follows the Toyota production system.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to find a way to convey this to his employees that they want to work smarter, not harder, by always improving the process. So no matter what it was, if it's packing a box, if we can shave 2 seconds off the process, then we've got that much improvement. And if we just continue to do that, 2 seconds here, 2 seconds there, obviously he meant, you know, if we could do 30 seconds or 40 seconds or a minute. Toyota, for example, is down where they are still trying to improve processes, and they're down to like thousands of a second.
Yeah.
At this point, and they're not stopping. But that is a good example. When you read his books, which are free, by the way, you can go online and you can get the PDFs, you can get the audiobooks, which are, I really recommend highly that people go and listen to. You'll understand that the idea that he has there is literally that if the process is good enough, then anybody can step in. And he doesn't mean it in the sense of like his workers are like easily replaceable cogs.
Right.
He thinks of it in a sense of anybody can step in any department and do the job. So, for example, one of the examples he gives is he has an $80,000 copier, and they had an expert there, you know, that was an expert on this copier to run it, and people would have to come in, and they would have to, you know, submit their jobs, and then they'd have to wait. And they just revamped the whole thing so that anyone can literally walk in, whatever they've got to do. There's very clear, easy instructions. There's very clear paper handling. You know, they have a system called Kanban, which is, it lets them know when we've reached this level of it, it's time to reorder. So they never run out of paper, for example. And they've basically eliminated that job of having one expert that's a bottleneck and made it so that anyone can walk in, and if the copier's free, they can run their job.
I bet that guy thought he had such job security for a long time. He's like, nobody else knows how to run this thing. I'm never getting fired.
Probably. Yeah, so he probably did, you know. But, you know, I would also bet that Paul did not fire him. He probably just, you know, found other things for him to do.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah, I know. But that is, you know, two examples of what I think that you're saying there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not to say that you want to just put anybody in any position, because if you find a great person with a great process, then it's a home run.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, one thing that I think a lot of businesses, especially small businesses, do, the owner usually can be really micromanaging and really controlling and not wanting to let go.
Yeah.
And will never set up good processes because he's afraid that someone is going to take that process and take their business away or something.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just here to say that if the choice is between being so very inefficient that you're essentially ruining people and you're just constantly churning through people because you don't have a good process, and having a nice, peaceful, beautiful existence where everything's just flowing, go with the latter. on that. Absolutely. You'll never regret it.
For sure. Well, we'll revisit this particular book when we go into our branding section. There's a couple examples that I'm going to use out of here. And I also have a few more books from this guy, Michael E. Gerber. He says he's the world's number one small business guru. So, well, at least it says here by Inc. I don't know what that means. But I thought it was pretty clever. So we'll review some more of his stuff and see what happens.
I kind of go with the what the Tao of Bruce Lee.
Yeah. You know,
and I mentioned this a couple times, but Bruce Lee often said, try everything, keep what works, discard what doesn't. You know, don't dismiss any kind of fighting style. Try it out, learn it, find its weaknesses, find its strengths, you know, keep the strengths, dismiss the weaknesses, and incorporate it into your own blend that makes your own fighting style.
There you go.
So,
well, I think that's it for this week, unless you got anything else.
I don't have anything else.
All right, man. Well, you can find us on turtlesmith.com, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Well, y'all take care, and we wish you a week of success.
Right on.